From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I was in Germany in 1936 and could not avoid seeing these headlines about the red swine dogs in Spain. All I needed was to read in a German paper that it was the red swine dogs to know whose side I was on there.
The Spanish Civil War. 70 years ago, Germany bombed Guernica, Spain, to support the fascist General Franco, who was attempting to overthrow the democratically elected government. Close to 3,000 Americans went to Spain to fight.
We were fighting against fascism, and we were political enough to understand that. So it wasn't for an adventure, and it wasn't for money. Fighting against Italy and Italian fascism and German Nazism.
Today, an hour on the Spanish Civil War and the Americans, women and men, who fought in it. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, nearly 80 people were killed and more than 170 injured in a car bombing Sunday in the holy city of Karbala. Meanwhile, April's become the deadliest month for U.S. troops so far this year. 9 service members were killed this weekend, bringing the toll to 103. In other news, a new audit has found more bad signs for U.S. reconstruction projects in Iraq. The New York Times reports American inspectors looked at 8 initiatives the Bush administration hails as signs of progress there. 7 were found to be no longer operational and were described as, quote, crumbling. New figures show the Bush administration has failed to live up to promises to allow even a limited number of Iraqi refugees into the United States. Just 68 Iraqis have been admitted in the last 6 months. Meanwhile, more than 1,300 Cubans and 2,400 Iranians have been taken in over the same period. Around 2 million Iraqis have fled Iraq since the U.S. invasion. The State Department is expected to report today another rise in the number of annual terrorist attacks. Figures from the National Counterterrorism Center show more than 14,000 attacks last year, up 30% from 2005. 45% of those attacks were in Iraq. The McClatchy News Service reports the State Department considered postponing or downplaying the report's release. Protests were held around the world Sunday on an international day of action to mark the 4th anniversary of the start of the conflict in Darfur. Marches were held in capitals including Washington, Rome, Tel Aviv, and London. Sudanese Member of Parliament Saleh Osman spoke out at an event in Cairo, Egypt.
The message is that the situation is still dire. People are dying on a daily basis. Survivors and victims in Darfur need protection. We ask the world to provide protection to the people and to help them go back to their homes.
The UN estimates at least 200,000 people have been killed and more than 2.5 million people displaced in what's called one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. In Afghanistan, thousands of people rallied against the U.S. military Sunday following a raid that killed at least 3 civilians. Demonstrators carried bodies of the victims and refused to leave a main road until surviving prisoners were released. This is an unidentified protester.
They're committing so many operations against us. We don't want them. We don't want this kind of life. America is our enemy. Karzai is our enemy.
In Germany, prosecutors have dropped a war crimes suit against former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and other U.S. officials. The New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights filed the complaint on behalf of a dozen victims of torture in U.S. custody. Germany's laws on torture and war crimes permit the prosecution of suspected war criminals wherever they may be found. But German prosecutors say they've dropped the case because it has no ties to crimes committed on German soil. Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights called the decision political, not legal, and said the case could be refiled in Spain. In Ecuador, the oil giant Chevron is being accused of causing massive environmental damage to the Amazon rainforest. Nearly 30,000 Amazon residents have filed suit against Chevron seeking $6 billion in damages. Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa traveled to the forest area to back the residents' case.
This is the damage caused. I insist. The damage caused in the Ecuadorian Amazon by mining by Chevron's Texaco. It's 30 times greater than the damage that the Exxon Valdez caused. But it looks like if it occurs in the third world, it doesn't matter.
In Argentina, today marks the 30th anniversary of the first action that launched the group, the Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo. On April 30th, 1977, a group of mothers who lost children under Argentina's military dictatorship met to trade stories and provide support. That meeting later spawned the first of scores of demonstrations and actions against Argentina's military leaders. This is Plaza de Mayo member Enriqueta Maroni.
It was during the time when desperation and pain forced us to look for our children. It was the only thing we wanted, to find our children. It was a painful time for us, and over time, we transformed it into struggle and then resistance, but an active resistance.
In Venezuela, leaders from several Latin American and Caribbean nations gathered this weekend for the fifth meeting of the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas, or ALBA. ALBA's four core members, Bolivia, Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua, formed the pact 2 years ago as an alternative to U.S.-backed trade deals. This is Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez.
ALBA continues to grow. Free trade is dead. Long live ALBA.
In news from Washington, D.C., Deputy Secretary of State Randall Tobias has resigned after it was revealed he frequented an escort service tied to prostitution. Tobias served as Director of U.S. Foreign Assistance and as the Bush administration's de facto aide czar. Tobias says he only used the escort service for massages. Tobias has previously come under criticism for promoting abstinence over condom use in the administration's AIDS policies. As the top official on AIDS funding, he was also responsible for a program that requires beneficiaries to renounce sex trafficking and prostitution. In Boston, a 25-year law school reunion for Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez turned into a protest at Harvard Law School Saturday. Student protesters heckled Gonzalez as he posed with former classmates. One student wore a black hood and orange jumpsuit like that worn by prisoners at Guantanamo. In New Orleans, hundreds of people rallied Saturday to call attention to the slow recovery of the Lower Ninth Ward. The area is one of the hardest hit by Hurricane Katrina. The Reverend Jesse Jackson helped lead the march.
Katrina will not be buried. The people will return to this zone because we will fight back, that we will not surrender.
The protest came amidst a new report showing the Bush administration has squandered hundreds of millions of dollars in foreign aid to Katrina victims. According to the Washington Post, the government has spent just $40 million of more than $850 million offered from U.S. allies. In Texas, a potentially major attack was avoided this weekend at an abortion clinic in Austin. Police say they arrested a man who placed an unexploded bomb containing nearly 2,000 nails, a propane tank, and a device similar to a rocket outside the clinic's doors. The former sidekick and producer fired along with radio host Don Imus has followed his dismissal with more controversial remarks. In his first interview since he was dismissed for calling the Rutgers women's basketball team hardcore hoes, Bernard McGuirk defended his comments to Fox anchors Sean Hannity and Alan Colmes.
Nobody uses the N-word. You just don't do that. But bees and hoes, I mean, that's just... Well, you know, we're just trying to keep, what am I going to say, dames? Those are some tough dames, man. What am I supposed to do?
Guys are dolls.
I mean, you know, we're competing in the marketplace.
McGuirk was joking with Fox host Alan Colmes. Later on in the interview, Colmes asked McGuirk about his hopes for the future.
What is my hope?
Yes. Get back to work.
Well, I hope that... Al Sharpton's blow dryer falls in the... No.
The Reverend Al Sharpton helped lead the protest for Imus' dismissal. Later in the broadcast, McGuirk went on to call Sharpton, quote, a terrorist. And finally, hundreds of people gathered at the Kendall Miami Dade College campus in Miami on Saturday to protest an appearance by President Bush. The protest was held in conjunction with National Impeachment Day. These are some of the voices from the protest.
I mean, how could a school that puts on the most wonderful book fair in the world invite the worst president in American history?
George Bush has
has done everything he can since he was governor of Texas to destroy public education in the U.S.
We must take a stand against war and stop the evil in this world and help our poor children. We must help the poor and stop the corporations from greed. Deal.
33 people died at Virginia Tech University. That would be a good day in Iraq.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. No man ever entered the earth more honorably than those who died in Spain. Those are the words of Ernest Hemingway. He was referring to the Americans who volunteered for the Spanish Civil War, the first major battle against fascism. In July 1936, right-wing military officers led by General Franco attempted to overthrow the newly elected democratic government of Spain. Hitler and Mussolini quickly joined in support of Franco. The Spanish Civil War lasted until 1939. 500,000 people are believed to have died on all sides. Yesterday in New York, hundreds gathered to honor an exhibit at the Museum of the City of New York called Facing Fascism. Among those there was Julia Newman, who made the film Into the Fire, American Women in the Spanish Civil War. The film begins with Martha Gellhorn, a world-renowned war correspondent. She was the second wife of Ernest Hemingway.
I was in Germany in 1936 and could not avoid seeing these headlines about the red swine dogs in Spain. I'd been in Spain, but I knew nothing about what had happened, that the king had gone, that there was a republic. But all I needed was to read in a German paper that it was the red swine dogs to know whose side I was on, theirs.
In spite of numerous and conflicting political terms used to classify the Spanish conflict, the fundamental issue lies neither between republicanism and fascism, nor between communism and monarchism. Mainly and simply, it is a war between the proletariat and the upper classes.
The Spanish called it La Causa, the cause. And it was the cause. It was the place where, of course, the Second World War could have been stopped, because it was a tryout for both Hitler and Mussolini.
By non-intervention, we were actually helping the fascists, because they were getting materials from everywhere. Everybody knew that. And to me, we didn't really believe in our democracy. It really shattered me. So I made that decision almost overnight.
Ruth Davidow, one of the nearly 80 American women who fought in the Spanish Civil War. They joined over 2,700 of their countrymen here in the United States in defiance of the U.S. government to volunteer for what was known as the Good Fight. The Americans who fought fascism in Spain called themselves the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. That clip was from an excerpt of Into the Fire that began with the third wife of Ernest Hemingway, the premier war correspondent, Martha Gellhorn. Julia Newman is the producer and director of that film, joining us in the studio today. Explain the significance of these women joining U.S. men in going to fight for Spain. Why you did this documentary?
They were extraordinary people, but they were ordinary people who had found their way to a cause that caught their heart. And this is part of my own background. My parents were supporters of the Republican side in the Spanish Civil War, and they had friends who fought and died in Spain. And I realized that I knew nothing about the fact that there were 80 women who had gone to Spain as volunteers to serve primarily as medicals in support of the international brigades. And I wanted that history to be known.
Explain who Martha Gellhorn was.
Martha Gellhorn was a writer and correspondent and a novelist who was quite well known in this country for a book she had written about the sufferings of the Americans under the Depression called The Trouble I've Seen. And Spain was her first foreign war, her first war of any kind, and she went there to see what was happening to the Spaniards in that war. She went there with Hemingway, actually. She followed him there. They had agreed to go together. And she began reporting from the fronts. She had never been a war correspondent before and was very caught up in the cause.
I wanted to go now to another clip of the film. The most famous attack in the Spanish Civil War came in 1937. almost 70 years ago to the day in the town of Guernica. At 4:40 p.m. on the 26th of April, 1937, German and Italian warplanes carpet bombed the Basque town. Three-quarters of Guernica was destroyed, and as many as 1,600 civilians were killed. The attack was immortalized in Pablo Picasso's Guernica, one of the most iconic paintings of the 20th century. Franco claimed the attack on Guernica never took place and was, in fact, Republican propaganda. This is how Virginia Cowles, a correspondent for the New York Times, described the incident. Her words are read by an actor.
Dictators will keep agreements only as long as they are profitable. They will maintain order only as long as might forces them to. They will talk peace only till the day when they think they can make a war and win it. When I arrived, a press officer asked if I'd been subjected to the Guernica propaganda, declaring that everyone knew that Guernica was not bombed by the whites, but burned by the reds. Guernica was a lonely chaos of timber and brick. One old man was inside an apartment house that had four sides to it, but an interior that was only a sea of bricks. I asked him if he had been in Guernica during the destruction. He nodded his head and declared that the sky had been black with planes. Aviones, he said. Italianos y alemanes. The press officer turned pale. Guernica was burned, he contradicted. The old man stuck to his point, insisting that after a four-hour bombardment, there was little left to burn. The press officer moved me away. He's a Red, he said. When later in the day we ran into two staff officers, he brought the subject up. Guernica's full of Reds, he said. They all try to tell us it was bombed, not burned. Of course it was bombed, said one of the officers. We bombed it, and bombed it, and bombed it. And bueno, why not? The press officer never mentioned Guernica again.
Virginia Cowles, she was writing for the New York Times. This from the film Into the Fire. Julia Newman, the significance of what was being said at the time.
Well, Virginia Cowles got to Guernica right after the bombing and was shown around Guernica by a press agent. And Franco was putting out propaganda that said that anarchists had burned, had set fire to the city, and that the Italians and the Germans had nothing to do with the destruction of the city. And Virginia Cowles got there and put the lie to that. She said what she saw. And what she saw was that the town had been just destroyed by German aircraft, primarily. It was a revelation.
It's interesting that recently in the New York Times, in reference to the exhibit facing fascism, that they put the term international fascism in quotes when you have here Virginia Cowles so powerful in describing fascism.
Mm-hmm. It's a bizarre thing to do all these years later to say that international fascism is something that you would even begin to put in quotes. It was very real. For a lot of people, it continues to be that.
And, of course, the Guernica, the famous painting by Pablo Picasso, is also in reproduction in a tapestry at the United Nations. And listeners and viewers may remember right before the invasion of Iraq, when Colin Powell came to the United Nations to push for war, February 5th, 2003. The tapestry of Guernica was shrouded so that that famous image of war, Picasso's anti-war painting, would not be the backdrop of the news conferences of the U.S. officials. When we come back, we'll be joined by two survivors of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
Freedom, flights are flying, guard your homes and check each glory, guard
Paul Robeson singing Freedom. The great singer Paul Robeson, a great supporter of the veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and those who went to fight in Spain on the 71st anniversary of the beginning of that war, the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Guernica. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. I want to turn to the words of one of the surviving veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, Clarence Kalin. He's 92 now. I interviewed Clarence a month ago at the Barrymore Theater in Madison, Wisconsin. Are you a pacifist?
Oh, yeah.
But you fought in the Spanish Civil War.
Yeah. Well, that takes a bit of an explanation of that we were fighting against fascism, and we were political enough to understand that. So it wasn't for an adventure, and it wasn't for money. It was fighting against Italy and Italian fascism and German Nazism. This is what it was about. And we felt that if we lost the war, that World War II was pretty much inevitable, which is what happened. And it happened because Britain and France and the United States refused to give us any help at all. So we fought barehanded at times.
Why didn't the U.S. intervene, and why did you go over as an American citizen without your government?
Well, yeah, our passports were stamped not valid for travel in Spain, so we had to go quietly and not tell people we were going. And we went because we understood what was happening over there, that Germany and Italy were both invading Spain and two fascist countries. And so we went to stop fascism. This is what it was about.
Did you go with anyone you knew?
Yes, I did. I went with there were six of us, two from Madison, two of us, and four from Milwaukee. And we went together.
Did you come back together?
No. I came back alone. It was sad. Because I lost my best friend, who was a very famous scientist, even at a young age. And he was killed right at the end of the fighting. It was a great shock to everybody.
You were injured also.
Yeah. I had a machine gun bullet in my right elbow.
In the same fight where you lost your friend?
No, he died later on. Yeah.
What was his name?
John Cookson. Yeah. Well, I wrote a book about him. And his story is in there.
What's the book called?
It's called Remembering John Cookson. Yeah.
How old was he when he died?
Huh?
How old was he when he died?
Oh, about 24. And the Spanish people felt that this book was so important that it was translated into Spanish. They published it there, a Spanish edition. So I was happy with that.
When you came back to the United States, how were you received here?
Well, that depends. Coolly in many areas, and our friends were very supportive. It was nice, but difficult.
Why coolly, and by who?
Well, you know, there was so much propaganda against us, and that's how public opinion was affected, you know. Although during the war, I think that about two-thirds of the public was supportive of what we were doing there. Yeah.
Why was it called the Abraham Lincoln Brigade?
Well, I guess they thought the people who named it, I think they thought Lincoln was one of the great leaders, one of the best presidents we've had. And I agree with that.
Clarence Kalin, he's 92. He's a survivor of the Spanish Civil War. I spoke to him in Madison, Wisconsin, though he was here in New York for the major event yesterday honoring those who fought in the Spanish Civil War. It happened at the City University of New York in the Museo del Barrio. And in a moment, we're going to be going to Harry Belafonte, who spoke there. But right now, one of those who attended is another Abraham Lincoln Brigade survivor, Mo Fishman, Executive Secretary of Veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigades, joining us in the Firehouse studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us, Mo. Talk about that time 71 years ago. The significance of the Spanish Civil War and how it relates to World War II. Do you think World War II would have happened if the outcome in the Spanish Civil War had been different?
I say no, and I'm reinforced by the fact that all of the Lincoln Brigade veterans felt the same way, and all of the International Brigade felt the same way. The International Brigade, of which we were a part, consisted of about 40 to 45,000 volunteers from 52 countries who came to the aid of the Spanish Republic, and I want to emphasize, came to the aid of. It was the Spanish Republic and their people who fought this war and deserved the major credit for the big fight that they put up, which gave the democracies a 2.5-year window of opportunity to change from a policy of appeasing fascism, led by Chamberlain of Britain and subscribed to by Roosevelt, to one of actively fighting fascism. If they had actively fought fascism in 1936, 39, we would have stopped Hitler and there would have been no World War II.
How would you have stopped Hitler? This was Spain, this was Franco. How would you have stopped Hitler?
Well, Hitler had been appeased by, they permitted him to rearm Germany. And it was done with the finances of both Britain and the United States. The financiers financed it on credit. They permitted Hitler to march into Austria. And then Spain came along, and they were letting him do as he felt in Spain with this policy of appeasement. If they'd have turned to fighting fascism and opposing what he was doing, Hitler would not have attempted a two-front war, which he was trying like mad to avoid. He would not have been armed as much as he became armed when he conquered one country after another and built a war machine that almost succeeded in conquering the world. And he would have been stopped. If there had been a conflict, and there might have been, he might have been rash enough to start something there, he would have had a two-front war to confront, and it would have been a minor kind of war. It would not have been World War II, where fascism almost won. And 60 million dead and destruction beyond compare, And no, there would have been no Holocaust if Hitler had been stopped in Spain in 1936-39.
Mo Fishman, I want to turn to another excerpt of the film Into the Fire. This clip begins with a narrator reading the words of Eleanor Roosevelt and ends with the words of Ernest Hemingway.
Three very interesting people came to dine with us last night. Miss Martha Gellhorn, Mr. Ernest Hemingway, both writers, and Mr. Joris Evans, a fearless maker of films. After dinner, the two men showed us a film which they made. The profits are going into the purchase of ambulances to help the sick and dying in a part of the world which is at present war-torn.
The men who never fought before, who were not trained in arms, who only wanted work and food, fight on.
That was the voice of Ernest Hemingway in this film called The Spanish Earth. But Roosevelt would not arm the Spanish government.
He joined in the non-intervention committee. He didn't join the committee, but he agreed with them, and he enforced an embargo in the United States, which called for no arms being sold to the Republic. Let me remind you, the Republic didn't want volunteers. The Republic didn't want anybody to join them. All they asked for is what was happening normally in the world at that time, where a democracy could just buy arms for money from another democracy. And this non-intervention committee formed by Chamberlain, agreed to by Roosevelt. So Roosevelt has an embargo and will not sell arms to Spain, will not sell them any trucks and so on and so forth. And this, if they had simply sold the arms, the Spanish Republic would have beaten the fascists.
Julia Newman, Eleanor Roosevelt disagreed with her husband. Eleanor Roosevelt was a close friend of Martha Gellhorn, the war correspondent.
Yes. She did everything she could to help convince FDR to go against the embargo. Ultimately, he was too politically frightened, I guess isn't too strong a word. He was a consummate politician, and he did not want to alienate what he saw as a collection of powerful lobbies in this country who were primarily Catholic, but who were pro-Franco. There was a strong movement here that was pro-Franco, along with the fact that most Americans were not.
Led by a powerful radio talk show host.
Named Father Coughlin. Yes, Father Coughlin was the radio priest. And he was quite rabid in rallying his listenership to Franco, to the right.
Mo Fishman, you are 91 years old right now. You fought in
young
the Spanish...
91.
Very young. You fought in the Spanish Civil War.
Yes.
When you came back, it was World War II, yet many of you were vilified. The FBI called you premature anti-fascists?
Yes.
What does that mean?
It means that you understood fascism before everybody else. They tried to make it a nasty word for, unfortunately, most American historians, fascism, the fight against fascism in the United States World War II doesn't begin until Pearl Harbor. This way they avoid dealing with the Spanish Civil War, dealing with the fact that Roosevelt, President of the United States, was wrong on this question, that World War II could have been prevented, he could have been one to do it, and secondly, we were dubbed Reds. It's not true that all who fought against fascism were Reds then, were Reds while the fight was going on in World War II, and are Reds today.
Speaking of that, I want to turn to another clip of Into the Fire, the women who fought. Into the Fire includes the voices of many American women who volunteered for the Spanish Civil War. Decades later, they described why they joined.
I couldn't be a nurse. I wasn't a nurse. I couldn't be a doctor because I wasn't a doctor. And I wanted to go. And I was doing a lot of driving. I helped to collect clothes and to advertise what was happening in Spain. And that's what gave me the idea in the first place. That if I could do that here, I could do it in Spain just as well. And that would replace some man who would then be able to do what I really wanted to do, which is go up front.
I met some friends and went to a meeting.
And the meeting was called for Spanish to aid Spanish democracy. All the different unions were supporting the group. They asked for nurses and doctors and volunteers to go to Spain. And so I volunteered. They called us in and started organizing the trip, meeting with the different people who were going, like Frederica Mott and Leni DeVries and my friend Annie Taft, who was graduated from the same school that I did. People had to resign from the jobs. Most of us were young nurses. And so that's why they had meetings to teach the young people what to expect when they get over there. How are you going to cope under these difficult situations? Can they do a good job while they leave responsibilities at home? Anyway, January 16, 1937, we left for Spain.
I think basically it was because I was a nurse that I was very upset about the kind of things that were happening, not only to Jews in Germany, people in Spain, and people in Ethiopia. And, you know, for a while, I thought this had nothing to do with us, that these people had to fight their own battles. I was against another world war. I was sort of an isolationist without thinking about it. But as things got worse, and when they went into a country that just had democratically elected a new government, and our own government, which said they were democratic and believe in elections, put an embargo on them, I was terribly upset.
I was not a political person because you shifted too much.
See, I didn't know about fascism. Here's the thing that brought everything to me. It was the way Germany was treating the Jews. I never really thought that white people do against white people because we don't look at you as French or Italian. You're white. I had met a lot of Jewish people who had left Germany, and they told us about what Hitler was doing to them. It was like the Ku Klux Klan. So now, we're matching what is happening in Germany to the Jews to us here in the United States. So I went downtown to this meeting, and the meeting was all these people from foreign countries. And they said to me that they hoped to go to work with the Republican side. So they said, would you like to go with us? I said, yes. The next thing I knew, I was accepted to go to Spain.
Personally, I went because my husband was there, and I got to Madrid early in October. And I felt I had a skill and I could work there. I could contribute to the fight against fascism that we knew was taking place.
Oh, it was all around me from the time the war started. By that time, I wasn't exactly politicized, but I was certainly aware. And I was in the United States Public Health Service, the Marine Hospital. It took care of the various trade unions from the waterfront early in 1937. I volunteered to the Spanish War Relief Organization. I had to pass some examinations.
And they wanted to be sure that they weren't sending out an adventurous. I was sort of overweight and I wore glasses on. I wore my hair in a bun. It was hardly likely I would look like an adventurer. It was just the same. And they all passed me and I went on to New York and joined up with a group of people from Chicago and here and there.
Somebody mentioned that nurses were needed in Spain, and I decided I would apply, and I was accepted immediately, and I was to leave in 1 month. There was one question that asked, why do you want to go to Spain? And all I wrote was to fight against fascism, and I was accepted.
The voices of women, almost 80, fought or went to Spain to participate in the Spanish Civil War, 1936-1939. Mo Fishman, we heard an African-American nurse describing her experience. What about the forces, the veterans being integrated, those who fought, the volunteers?
The Abraham Lincoln Brigade was the first American military unit that was completely integrated. We had officers, we had ordinary soldiers, sergeants, etc. It didn't happen in World War II, where our black brothers from the United States fought so valiantly with white officers. And it didn't happen until Truman, in 1948, integrated the United States Army by an official decree. He didn't dare go to Congress to do it. I want to make one more point. Fascism, the word has been bandied about a lot. And I want people to remember that it is not just the racist aspect of fascism. If you want to understand fascism, it is the negation of everything that is democratic. It makes it impossible to have a trade union, a neighborhood organization, to fight for civil liberties. It is a system that is terrible. And in conclusion, I'd like to tell you that there is a monument that we're very proud of that's going up in San Francisco on the Embarcadero. And if you would like to send some funds, get on your computer and contact www.alba-valb.com. And thank you. We'd appreciate any contribution you make.
.org, is that?
Yes, .org.
Thank you so much, Mo Fishman, Executive Secretary of the Veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigades, and Julia Newman, who directed and produced Into the Fire, American Women in Spanish Civil War. When we come back, Harry Belafonte, he honored the veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade here in New York yesterday. Stay with us.
Oh, I'm glad I got that early.
Paul Robeson, All Men Are Brothers, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to the event yesterday honoring veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, as hundreds gathered to honor the exhibit at the Museum of the City of New York called Facing Fascism. Across the street at the Museo del Barrio, one of the speakers was the actor, humanitarian, singer, Harry Belafonte.
One of the great rewards in being a part of today's ceremony was the knowledge that, having just turned 80, that I would be sharing this platform mostly with people who are much older than I am. But even in that delight, one cannot overlook the fact that all who are gathered here represent an important part of the American soul, an important part of what this nation is really about. When I entered into the building just a few moments ago, a lady thrust in my hand a button that I thought would be far more fitting than a carnation. And it just simply says, "It's a man's world until women vote." It's about today. It's about the climate of our times. It's about where we stand as a result of the remarkable sacrifices made by valiant men and women who, in the dawning of the 20th century, did much to shape the idea of an America that we've all aspired to since their time. The workers of America did much in coming together to try to shape a society that would be forever devoted to the dignity of the working class and would try to make a nation that would be forever conscious about its diversity, about its opportunity, and would forever be committed to the idea that we lived in a world where our humanity should be the first item of our consideration and all else after. When I was a youth, much was said about what went on in Spain and the war in 1936 when it started, and 1937 when the Lincoln Brigade and the international forces from around the world came together to fight against fascism in Spain, and the great price and the great heroism that was displayed during that struggle by the men and women of the world who tried to greet the dawning of fascism in all of its vicious aspects. It was they who clearly alerted the world to the fact that the 20th century would not be a century of calm, that unfortunately it would not be a century of peace, that the military-industrial complex was very much on the rise, and that all people, all decent people in the world, would have to be vigilant about what this union of tyranny would visit upon the nations of the world. It is almost ironic, but cannot be viewed without note. The last thing that Dwight D. Eisenhower said, or one of the last things in his presidency, at the end of his presidency, was he warned that the American citizens, of all the things they must be mindful of, was that they should be vigilant and mindful of what was going on with the military-industrial complex in this nation. That it is an entity that we should be most cautious of. And no words could have been more prophetic. It was not the first time such utterances were made. They were made constantly by all the great union leaders and all the great forces of the early part of that century that did much to try to shape the unification of a world that was emerging to find a place of dignity and a place of commonality. It was a place where colonialism for so long had dominated the affairs of the nations of the world, Africans, Asians, people in Latin America, and the indigenous. It was a place here in America where workers were constantly battling for a decent wage and a decent way of life in the midst of those who were stimulated by greed and avarice would forever try to diminish the dignities of workers and would try to do what they have done so consistently. That force is still in our midst and has been very glaringly demonstrated by what has happened with the Bush administration and what they have done to this nation over the last few years. I made an utterance not too long ago describing Bush as the greatest tyrant in the world. I was somewhat hasty. I was somewhat hasty in making that remark, because the truth of the matter is that since I have not met all the great tyrants in the world, I'm not sure that he could be number one. But he's a damn good candidate. And as the people in the world struggle to lift the weight of oppression off of their shoulders and their backs, it is indeed a time for all of us to be of heart, for all of us to feel stimulated by what the future promises. As the left struggles to find its course for the 21st century, as it struggles to come together to find a purpose and to find goals that can tie us together in a much more compelling way than we've been able to do up to now, we have promise in our midst. When you look at the kinds of gains that are being made by the workers and the people in Latin America, throughout Bolivia and throughout Venezuela, that the revolution in Cuba, as it continues to try to build and find its way into a greater society, still sustains and still gives hope to people all over the world. And as I move across the length and breadth of this country, much of my time is spent with what Frantz Fanon would call the wretched of the earth. I spend a great deal of time among men and women who serve in the prisons of America. I'm awakened to their plight because Paul Robeson and Dr. Du Bois and others warned of this moment and told us to be vigilant and to be aware of all that would take place as we continue to struggle against the forces of fascism and against the compelling agenda of the right. Dr. Martin Luther King once said to me, when coming from an encounter with gangs in the ghettos of America, he said, "You know, I share more with the young men and women in struggle in the ghettos of our nation than I do with those who have attained lofty heights and who delight in their middle-class pleasures. I would gladly trade 500 prisoners in the ranks of our struggle, and I would in exchange give you 15,000 Baptist ministers." And so, with that rather curious and interesting remark, there came a time when I thought that the best work that I could possibly engage myself in would be to go into the darkest places of American society, to go into the heart of the Latino community, of the Native American community, where the greatest suffering can be revealed, and to go into the heart of the black community across the length and breadth of this nation and speak to the young. And although for a long time, in the last 25 odd years, one could have said our youth seemed to have lost its way, somehow we treat it as if the choice was exclusively theirs. But those who preceded the young of this generation did much in blundering in the way in which we passed the baton. So busy were we moving into the new successes that the civil rights movement had unfolded for us that we abandoned the revolution. And while we filled seats in the legislative halls of America, while we filled new places in the economic affairs of America, we left our communities. And our young people for a long time did not know quite where to go. And in the midst of their own pain and degradation, did what we had to do back in the 1930s. They had to turn to themselves and look to themselves for solutions to the needs of the day. And it is in their midst that so many young leaders sit and are studying and are emerging that I think will be very encouraging for what the future of America will look like. When I go across America into the on the reservations of this country among Native Americans and listen to what young Indian men and women are saying, when I move across the length and breadth of this country into California among workers, the Latino youth and newly arriving immigrants, what they have to say, when I move among the communities of the black underclass and I listen to what the young people there have to say, I am heartened. And I'm encouraged that the legacy that has been left to us by the men and women who so valiantly struggled in the early parts of the 20th century, the example set by the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and all anti-fascist forces has indeed not died. Those flames of hope have been reawakened in the hearts and the minds of our young people, and they're coming together. They're speaking. They're seeking, they're looking for leadership, they're looking for answers. And each time I go among them and speak about the great noble things of our past, they take heart. Their eyes flash brightness, their minds become awake, and they begin to dig into the blueprints of their history, and they find courage and they find purpose. I stand and I speak in their name when I say to the Lincoln Brigade, thank you so much for what you've given all of us. Me and my youth and the youth of today, without your courage, without your vigilance, without your insight, America could never have hung on as tenaciously as we have done to the things that are decent about this country. It is your example. It is that which you have given us that has helped guide us through some of the darkest times in the history of this nation. We defeated Hitler, but we did not defeat fascism. We defeated McCarthy, but we did not defeat fascism. And now, as George W. Bush sits in the wake of his own destruction, we are still going to have to deal with fascism because it is not easily killed. It is not easily crushed. We still have work to do. We must still be vigilant. And all we need to do when we have moments of doubt is to look back at what was given us by the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and the valiant sacrifices that were made by them to know what we have to do in our time. Robeson. Robeson, when I visited him in his last days in Philadelphia, when I asked him about the journey that he had been on, I asked him whether, with all that he had achieved and the sacrifices that he had made, did he, in the final analysis, feel that it was all worth the pain and the anguish? And he said in a halting voice, "Never doubt the fact that the path that I've taken has served me well. It was an honorable one, and one that if I had to do again, I would do it all over again." He said, "It is not the victories that we may have gained or the losses we may have experienced, but it is in fact the journey itself that makes the difference. It is the men and the women and the courageous moments that are revealed to us that makes the journey towards freedom, towards human dignity, a battle and a journey worth taking. And I'm glad I was on it." He said, "But I must tell you something. No matter what we may have achieved in our lifetime, the generations who come after us will always feel that we never did enough." Well, as true as that may be, he also added this. He said, "But in the final analysis, no matter what is said, each generation must be responsible for itself. And in the midst of my time and my youth, when I volunteered to serve in the United States Armed Forces during the Second World War, as a munitions loader in the United States Navy, and then subsequently coming from that service into an America that, instead of giving the veterans of our time the rewards that we deserved for having been victorious against the armies of fascism, we came back to an America that was more cruel than ever. Segregation was fanned as a new flame. The tyrants of our time came to the fore to try to maintain business as usual. And we said there will be no such, we cannot accept such an agenda. And as we looked around the world, we found others in Asia and Africa who also thought they would be rewarded by the success that had been achieved in the battlefields of the world against fascism. But all those nations..."
Harry Belafonte speaking this weekend, honoring the new exhibit at the City of New York called Facing Fascism, New York and the Spanish Civil War. If you'd like a copy of today's broadcast, you can go to our website at democracynow.org to get a DVD. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdulkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Matei, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Noguera are our engineers. Special thanks to Norm Stockwell. And thanks to Angela Alston, Becca Staley, Hugh Grant, Tyshawn Black, John Randolph, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Tori Townsend, Nicole Salazar, Samantha Chambly. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.